From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the governor's Flint water emails. What's there and what new questions have they opened up?
If you live in Flint, when will we know and how will we know when our water is safe to drink?
The president takes a victory lap in Detroit celebrating the auto bailout.
I don't think there's any question that you could say that this was a major achievement by this administration.
From his start as an NPR intern to the creator and host of the widely acclaimed This American Life, we'll hear from Ira Glass.
We were applying the tools of journalism mostly to stories that were very small and personal, and so small and personal that journalism wouldn't have traditionally covered them.
And we'll hear about Ira's upcoming appearance in Michigan. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder released more than 270 pages of emails related to the Flint water crisis yesterday. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith will share some of the highlights later in the hour. But first, a new study finds there are many challenges to Detroit residents accessing job opportunities. The report, Detroit's Untapped Talent, Jobs and On-Ramps Needed, was commissioned by J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and was compiled by a corporation for a skilled workforce. Janine LaPrade helped prepare the report, and she is with us now. Janine, the Detroit unemployment rate is chronically twice that of the statewide rate. What did the report find was among the causes of that high unemployment?
Thank you, Cynthia.
That Detroit unemployment rate, it's chronically twice that of the statewide unemployment rate. What did the report find was among the causes of that high unemployment?
Yeah, and I appreciate that you use the word chronic because really that is the story or a story in terms of the history of chronic unemployment in Detroit for a number of residents. That factor has been compounded by what we found through the study, which is not enough jobs in the city of Detroit itself, a mismatch between the skills and the educational attainment level of many residents with what's being required for the jobs that are available, and then also just some of the challenges that lower-income residents face in terms of being able to access education and training opportunities, find the jobs, get the transportation they need to get to those jobs, and then also have some of the supportive things that many of us have that we take for granted, access to childcare and other things that help people get to work and to education if that's the path that they're on.
I think the story that grabbed really the nation, if not the world, was that of that Detroit gentleman, James Robertson, when it was discovered that he walked 21 miles to get to his job in the suburbs and did it night after night after night.
It's important to recognize that in many places around the country, residents within inner cities often find work in the suburbs, and that's certainly the case here in Detroit. A lot of the employment opportunities for many of the residents in Detroit who have mostly or many of them entry-level skills are in the suburbs. And so when you don't have a regional transportation system that makes it easier for people to get to those kinds of jobs, as other cities do, that is really compounding the challenges that Detroit residents are facing currently.
And we should certainly point out that the report finds that young blacks are more than twice as likely to be unemployed. Why?
That's right. And so the same is true actually for adult black men. Again, those statistics are pretty typical for what you might find in other urban centers. However, in Detroit, one of the concerns is just the lack of engagement of black youth in any of these opportunities, any of these programs. And it really does take a whole system to try to engage youth in different ways. And so we're seeing some movement toward a focus on summer youth employment, certainly in Detroit. But there's also some work going on to look more systemically at the different places where youth might become more engaged and be interested in connecting up to some kind of educational or career pathway. Engagement is what I think ultimately is critical. The relationship part of it is also a driver for engagement.
And then circling back to education, such a key factor in whether someone can find a job anywhere. I mean, we just have to look at the teacher sick outs in the city of Detroit and the never-ending headlines about the fact that DPS could be out of money by April or May.
That's right. From an educational perspective, one of the things that's important in terms of workforce development is that adult education becomes really critical, especially as people are trying to figure out how to get the more basic set of skills that they need for the work that's out there right now. And a lot of the adult education programs have been under or disinvested in over the years. A number of them are tied into the public school system. So we're really trying to look for different ways in which the community colleges, higher education institutions can begin to partner differently with the school system, but also the workforce development providers that are in the city, because it's going to take those kinds of partnerships to create these sort of pathways or these ramps.
These ramps.
Exactly. We're starting to see some examples where companies from a particular industry sector are reaching out to and starting to form partnerships with some of the higher education institutions and community colleges in the region.
What are some of those industries we're seeing?
There's been work in the city with the anchor institutions for a while now, whereby the healthcare system in particular has taken a closer look at its own workforce needs and has begun to talk more with city leadership about the short-term and longer-term implications. And then they're starting to reach out again to these higher ed institutions to say, let's partner on some type of pathway and program that would really start to create these on-ramps for Detroit residents. We're seeing the same thing happening in IT. That's also an area where traditionally it's not as diverse of a workforce as we need to see. A lot of attention being paid to how do you look for more equitable ways to open up these opportunities.
What are some of the other things happening? Because I pounced on what these some of these initiatives with business and education. What are some other ways you're seeing this
happen? So I think from the economic development and job creation side of things, you know, the mayor has certainly picked up on the data point where we compared Detroit to other cities and what was happening in Detroit in terms of the hollowing out of jobs. So we did call attention to the lack of private sector jobs in the city compared to other places and some of the sectors where that lack is really clear are in areas like hospitality, retail trade, arts and entertainment. So all of those parts of our economy that suggest that a city is thriving, that's where I think the mayor is really thinking about, all right, how do we continue to create an ecosystem where those kinds of jobs become more available? And so I think that's one strategy that they're looking at. He's forming partnerships with a lot of other developers and groups that are coming in to try to create more jobs in the city. And one of the things they're looking at is how do you get those companies to make commitments to not only hiring Detroiters, but really also maybe investing in training in a different way. So I think that's a critical strategy. And again, it's going to take a private-public sector partnership to really move the needle on all of this.
We're talking about the report, Detroit's Untapped Talent, Jobs and On-Ramps Needed. It was commissioned by J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and compiled by the Corporation for a Skilled Workforce. And Janine LaPrade helped prepare this report. Janine, your report also found even if someone has a job, it doesn't mean that they will necessarily escape poverty. Why is that?
That's right. Again, the fact that a number of residents are traveling outside of the city to find employment, especially in mostly the lower wage service sector, is just not necessarily getting people out of poverty. We still have situations where people are working and they're still relying on some form of public assistance, not necessarily government assistance, but just the support of the community to make ends meet, to make things work. It's important to really look at that population too, because I think there are some things that companies can do, the leaders in the community can do to really help focus on how do we help those people move up or advance in the labor market, because that's also going to create some opportunities for others to move into jobs they're vacating. That needs to be part of the strategy. And we're seeing the Kellogg Foundation and some others really looking at something called two-generation strategies, which is an approach that looks at both youth as well as their parents simultaneously. Some of those strategies are cost maybe more than a traditional program where you're serving either the parent or the youth. Those kinds of programs or those strategies are really critical to consider, because we're seeing that even in situations where kids are in schools in Detroit and doing well, they're still struggling because their parents are struggling. we can't pit these strategies against each other. We have to find a way to link them.
What do you feel after diving into this and in helping to prepare this report? What do you feel is the bottom line of your report?
The bottom line is there is no silver bullet here, and this is a complex set of factors that are underpinning the level of unemployment we are seeing and the labor force participation rates. It really is going to be critical that every organization, every program, every provider in the city, whether it be from an educational perspective, the workforce development perspective, the human service, social service perspective, we all really take a closer look at what it is we're doing and how is it that collectively we might be able to better align our resources, our programs, our strategies, so that this more holistic, more comprehensive approach could be taken.
This is the first of two reports.
That's correct.
What can we expect from the upcoming second one?
Yeah. So the second report is really focused on the infrastructure. So what is in place from a partnership perspective? So I mentioned a couple of examples in healthcare and IT. And then what's happening on the organizational and program side of things in terms of the kinds of supports and services that are available. So what we've done is mapped that to show the array of resources that do exist, but then to also illuminate where the gaps are. And so we're hoping that that report combined with this data will really give the mayor's office, other stakeholders in the city, the private sector leadership and the philanthropic leadership that's being engaged through the mayor's workforce development board, that all forms the basis for their strategies and solutions that they're working to create.
A good roadmap.
Exactly.
A good roadmap. Janine LaPrad is with the Corporation for a Skilled Workforce, and she helped prepare this report, Detroit's Untapped Talent, Jobs and On-Ramps Needed. Thanks so much for being with us, Janine.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In this, his final year in office, President Obama's trip to Detroit on Wednesday was a way to call the nation's attention to one of his most significant decisions, to bail out the auto industry.
There's only one Detroit, and if you're looking for the world's best cars and the workers who make those cars, you need to be in Detroit, Michigan.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us now talking about this $85 billion government gamble. And you posed the question in your column today for the news, Daniel. Would any president, Democrat or Republican, have done the same for this leading American industry?
Yes, I think the short answer. And I think, in fact, we have in our contemporary era an example of that. President Bush began the bailout by putting forth, I forget the number now off the top of my head, I want to say $14 or $20 billion to keep General Motors and Chrysler afloat so President Obama could deal with the problem. And I think if you look at President Bush's memoir on this called Decision Points, he talks about this and how he basically had to do this and felt like he had to do it. He couldn't take the economic risk in the industrial Midwest. But more broadly, I think we have to recognize that the patch of land that we inhabit here and these car companies inhabit is still vitally important to any presidential campaign, Republican or Democrat. I mean, we know that Ohio is one of the biggest battleground states there is. Michigan is very important in the electoral map, and certainly this was and is and will be a cornerstone industry of the American economy for some time to come.
Yeah, as you kind of spell out, these were tough calls, and there wasn't a lot of time to get things done before GM and Chrysler slid over the cliff.
That's exactly right, and I think you have to look at what this administration and his automotive task force actually did. They did bring and demand some rigor in exchange for the money. General Motors ended up cutting four brands. It got a lot leaner in terms of how it operated. They cleaned out a whole cadre of senior executives at both GM and Chrysler, not directly under the orders of the government, but clearly when the new management came in at the top, they got rid of a whole lot of people. So you have a whole different management structure in both these companies. I don't think there's any question that you could say that this was a major achievement by this administration. Whether you like the president's politics or you don't, I think you have to weigh the result against the potential cost. And I think the potential cost would have been far greater than what the Treasury ultimately netted out of this.
Yeah. It certainly, as you think about looking at that big picture, the rigor and the house cleaning that came, they were needed, weren't they?
Well, they were. And a point I didn't go into in today's column, but I think it's really important for readers to be – or listeners, rather, to be reminded of is this isn't just GM and Chrysler's perspective. I mean, Ford Motor Company, Toyota, and Honda were very afraid of a systemic collapse. And privately and behind the scenes, they put together essentially a fund that was going to keep the supply base running in the event of a collapse of General Motors and or Chrysler. Mm. That has been reported since that time in books and in newspaper articles and things. But here were people who were in the industry who knew far more than anybody at the Automotive Task Force or any people out there listening who worked in the auto companies 20 years ago. These people were living through it, and they were terrified about what could have happened here. And they were planning a way to keep the supply base functioning so the industry wouldn't totally collapse.
Wow, what a story that is. Yeah, it was interesting to note when President Obama was at Kobo yesterday going through the auto show, he spent his time pretty much looking at electrics and hybrids. And, of course, we know that mirrors his administration's push for tougher fuel economy standards. Mm-hmm. But if you look at what the public's looking at, it's showing its love for the SUVs and the pickups and the crossovers, right?
That's exactly right, although I think a little yellow Corvette did catch his eye.
But, it did.
I mean, the irony of this is this president and a lot of other politicians who want to preach to everybody about how they need to be driving around in electric vehicles and hybrids spend all their time in large SUVs. Now, I understand the president has to have a special – it is a Cadillac, I believe,
the
so-called beast.
Yeah.
Yeah. Has to have a special kind of vehicle. But a lot of other people are driving around in their big black Suburbans, which is great for General Motors, obviously. But they're not riding around in those kind of cars. And I think we're really looking – getting to an inflection point in terms of electric vehicles in the next few years is more and more companies are putting more and more resources behind them. And at some point, we're going to ever have a real frank discussion in this country about whether people are actually going to buy them. And I think at gas prices, certainly the way they are now, I wouldn't expect to see a real uptick in those vehicles, at least in the near term. So I think we have to wait and see how that plays out over the long term. But I think midterm, people think fuel prices are going to be a lot lower than they thought they were going to be.
Reflecting on the president's visit to the Detroit Auto Show and looking back at the Obama auto bailout legacy, Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you want proof that an internship can be a portal to a pretty eye-popping career, here it is. My next guest began his career at 19 as an intern for NPR. That was in 1978. Since then, he has done just about every job you can think of at NPR Washington, from writer to editor, reporter to producer. And then he created and hosted This American Life. From that first episode on November 17, 1995, the program has grown to the point where today it is heard weekly by more than 2 million listeners on more than 500 public radio stations, including right here on Michigan Radio. And more than 2 million listeners also download the program. And now Ira Glass is hitting the road. He'll be in Kalamazoo January 24th to talk about his Peabody Award-winning program. And he is with us now, Ira Glass. Welcome to Stateside.
Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. You know, it really does give one pause to realize that you truly possess the ultimate internship success story. I'm wondering, what were your career hopes when you first walked in the door as an NPR intern?
None. I'm sorry, I had to pause there. My hopes were nothing. I didn't think of what I was doing as a career move. All I was thinking of is I wanted to do something interesting that would be interesting for this summer. And kind of talked my way in, and then it kind of at every stage there was no plan. It was just like what would be kind of interesting to do next.
When I think of those very early days when you were at NPR, we're talking about Washington in 1978, and you stop and you think about that point in history. It was just 4 short years after the Nixon resignation because of Watergate. Jimmy Carter was in the White House. It was a full year before those Americans were taken hostage in Tehran, 2 years before America said yes to Ronald Reagan. It seems like a long time ago, or no?
I mean, it seems like a long time ago to me. Like, I'm old. Like, I know I'm old. Like, yeah, no, that seems like a really long time ago. Yeah, for sure. And but I, you know, I'm glad I was able to have a nice job for all this time.
Where did the idea of This American Life come from? What was the germ?
I mean, the germ was really something pretty simple, which is that there was a kind of story that I was doing for the NPR news shows, sometimes as a producer and sometimes as a reporter, and had been doing it for years. And you know, the kinds of stories where there's characters and scenes and funny moments and emotional moments. And you know, we'd be covering the news and covering things related to the news. You know, like NPR gave me an assignment where they had me go cover one high school for a year, a high school that was trying to go through a sort of a massive reform and fix their school. And I reported every couple of weeks for All Things Considered. And over the course of the year, the audience got to know these teachers and the principal and what they were trying to do and what worked and what didn't work. And so I was doing stories like that. And then I just thought, like, well, you could have a whole show, which was nothing but these stories. And it just seemed like, well, that's such an obvious thing. You know, you think about, like, you know, listening to the daily news shows in addition to the news. I feel like for many of us, like, our favorite stories are the ones where, like, the driveway moments kinds of stories. I thought, well, let's just do a show of those stories.
And as you and I speak, show number 577, Something Only I Can See, is set to air this week. So here you are, 20 years out, you have millions of listeners, you're a Peabody Award winner. You and I know that the lifespan of many fine shows can sadly be too short. Why do you think This American Life is still going strong at age 20?
I think that there are two things. I mean, one is I think that the thing we're doing is just very likable. Like you know, like we're doing stories that are very traditional stories and stories, you know, like you tell a kid, like the characters you can relate to and, you know, there's a plot and you want to find out what happens. And so I feel like the thing we're making, the thing that attracts me to the stories is what attracts the audience to the stories. And so there's that. And then honestly, like I've been very careful about the way it runs as a business and was always very interested in that. And, you know, just from the very beginning where we had to talk public radio stations into picking us up and the way we treat stations during the pledge drive and, you know, just try to do a nice job during the pledge drive for stations and just like all the little things that are the business side of doing a public radio show. I feel like we you know, like I and my staff have tried to do a nice job on
watering the garden. I'm wondering if the kinds of stories that you find and you present on This American Life, have they changed over these two decades or do they maintain a pretty steady course?
I mean, there are some things that are the same in there, but there are a few things that are different. I mean, the things that are the same are that, like, at its heart, you know, it's a show which is narrative stories, which is, you know, there's stories with a plot and things happen and you get to know somebody. Like, and so that was there at the beginning. The thing that's changed is that at the beginning, like when we went on the air 20 years ago, we were applying the tools of journalism mostly to stories that were very small and personal. And so small and personal that journalism wouldn't have traditionally covered them. And then the 20 years since, like memoirs and, you know, personal stories and reality TV, you know, this is long ago enough that all of that has come since then.
Right.
And I feel like all that stuff is way more familiar and way more like in the culture. And so I feel like we've moved away from that. And now, like a lot of the most interesting stuff, I think, is stuff where we're reacting to the news and taking the storytelling moves that we do and applying it to the financial crisis or to desegregation of public schools or to the war on terror, like all kinds of things that the news covers that we feel like it's interesting to cover in our style.
We're talking with Ira Glass, who will be in Kalamazoo January 24th, talking about his Peabody Award-winning program, This American Life. Give us an idea. What is your road show like? What are you going to be doing in Kalamazoo on the 24th?
I mean, I stand on stage. I have an iPad, excuse me, which lets me play clips and music. And so I can basically recreate the sound of the stories around me as I speak. And so it's both kind of like a greatest hits here, really incredibly funny moments or moving moments from the show. But also it's me talking about how we make the show, like what's the theory behind it, like what's the theory behind the way the stories work so that they work with greatest effectiveness. So that's it.
It must be good to get out of the studio and out there in front of an audience and to see and to hear them react to things you say and clips you play for them.
It is totally the opposite of an experience from doing a radio show. Like a radio show, like I feel like I go into the studio and I say my lines – And it's a completely soundproof room, and I pretend that I'm talking to people. But, you know, it's very abstract, the notion that I'm actually talking to people, and so it's nice to be in the room with people. Yeah, like, yeah. It's very, very different. And then the first time I did it, I hadn't been, once I started making This American Life, I had been doing radio for a while, but I was in my mid-30s, and I hadn't been on stage since high school theater. And so it was very strange to be on stage.
I think about the media landscape, and you've just alluded to this. The media landscape in 2016 is so different from what it was when you first launched This American Life. No internet then, no podcast, no bloggers. Do you think our national discourse has been improved through all of this, or have things changed for the worse?
Oh, I think definitely not for the worse. No. I don't know. I think that there's a kind of person who thinks everything's always getting worse. But I am definitely not one of those people. I don't know if it's better. but I don't mind it. In fact, I kind of like the way things are. I like that there's all these different sources of information, and honestly, we're in this cultural moment where it's possible for anybody to make something and get an audience and be able to support themselves. There are all sorts of shows that started off as podcasts before they even had many radio stations. Radiolab was really a podcast before it was, a big radio show. And my wife for a while worked for this 15-year-old named Tavi Gevinson, who has a website called Rookie. And my wife was her, the adult who kind of made the trains run on time. It was just this incredibly wonderful site for teenage girls written by this army of young women and just really funny and innovative and just beautifully written. And I feel that can happen now. That mm-hmm. Somebody, just starting off can try to make something and can find an audience. And if it's good, I feel like it's more of a meritocracy. I think there are a lot of messed up things in the world right now. But the one thing that is really lovely and better than when I was starting to try to do creative work is that there's all kinds of ways, if you're young, to get your work out there.
Ira Glass, when you think of that title, This American Life, what do you think an American life means in 2016? What does that title mean?
Well, here you're speaking. This is a very good question, and you're speaking to the utter pretentiousness of the title of the show, which is just not really, I have to say, the very best title for a show. I think the thing we mean by the title, I and the staff, is all of these are American lives. The things happening, for middle class people and for not middle class people, and it's all part of the whole.
When you think of listeners of the future going into those audio archives, all of us in this business can think about the fact that our work's going to live on, and our voices and our words and what we've done will live on long after we've departed this earth. Will you think of people listening in the future to episodes of American Life and to those voices and the stories?
I don't. No.
I don't think it's going to happen.
Nope. Don't think it's going to happen.
Why?
I think that we'll be on the air for a while and then we'll be off the air and then we will vanish into the sand like everything else. And I think that is just fine.
I don't
think of people in the future hearing us. I think it's fine. In fact, I've been in kind of a discussion with the public radio station that we're based with, WBEZ in Chicago, because, Car Talk, one of those guys died.
Yes.
And the show is still on the air on hundreds of radio stations. I just feel like I would never want that to happen with our show. I feel like, and I've been in these negotiations with WBEZ where I've said no, once I'm dead, take the show off the air. And they're like, I don't know. I think we can make some more pledge money. I've said, no, don't make any more. I don't care if people will pledge. I just think our mission is excellence. And I'm happy to get out of the way for younger living producers to get their shows on the air. I think it's fine for our show to not be on the air anymore. I think it's fine for our show to be a thing that people enjoyed for a while. And then when I'm dead, when the staff is dead, I feel like it's fine for it to go away forever.
I'm just curious to know, if you had not landed that NPR internship back in 78, and you said you had zero aspirations, you just wanted something interesting to do when you were 19, do you have any sense of what other career path you might have followed?
Yeah. I mean, my parents were very much wanted me to be a doctor. And I was good at science, and there's things about it that I like. If I hadn't ever gotten a job in the media, I could have very, very possibly gone down that road.
That makes two of us, actually. I was on the road to becoming a surgeon, and then somehow you get sidetracked, and here we are in the studio doing our thing.
So I got as far as organic chemistry. How far did you get?
Organic chemistry. That I got a D in organic chem lab and said, I don't think I belong in this field. And I went and switched to history.
Yeah.
We could commiserate over organic chem.
There you go.
How many physicians will tell you, never use it, never use it.
Yeah.
Ira Glass will be speaking on Sunday, January 24th at 3 p.m. at Miller Auditorium in Kalamazoo. You can get all the details and tickets at the website, MillerAuditorium.com. And, of course, you can hear This American Life every Saturday at 1 p.m. and Sunday at 3 p.m. right here on Michigan Radio. Looking forward to having you here in Michigan, Ira Glass, and thank you so much for spending time with us today on Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Late word today, Governor Rick Snyder is expected to be called to testify about the Flint water crisis on Capitol Hill. According to the office of Southfield Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee is scheduling a hearing for Wednesday, February 3rd, to dig into the Flint water disaster and the government's response. This would be the first congressional inquiry into Flint. Lawrence is a member of that committee. Meantime, reporters and the public are combing through nearly 300 pages of emails released by the governor late yesterday, from emails from 2014 and 2015. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith's been covering the Flint water story for many, many months, certainly long before it became the international story it has become today. Lindsay, your blog post at MichiganRadio.org notes there were no obvious bombshells for you, but what were some of the highlights, if any, for you?
I think the highlights were definitely the Dennis Muchmore emails. Dennis Muchmore is Governor Snyder's former chief of staff. He just recently left the governor's staff, unrelated to the Flint water crisis, I might add. He kind of came up in an earlier batch of FOIA requests on the Department of Health and Human Services side. It came out in late December that Muchmore had sent an email to the director of the Department of Health that said, essentially, you know, can you guys dig around on this lead issue? I feel like we, the state, are kind of blowing off residents. So it was interesting to see some of the emails that Muchmore sent Rick Snyder, which didn't come until really September, it looks like, that we're really more on the lead issue. And it's just interesting, some of the things that he says about how, you know, different players at the time, Congressman Kildee and Mayor Walling at the time, just sort of how they felt it was being handled or being framed. And he wasn't sure why it was considered the state's fault at one point. He kind of points that out. Those are sort of the more interesting emails that I saw.
It kind of struck me, or tell me I'm wrong, as he writes, I can't figure out why the state's responsible except that then state treasurer Andy Dillon did make the ultimate decision, so we aren't able to avoid this subject. Does this sound at all like, you know, let's point the finger at somebody who's left, is long gone, you know, at Andy Dillon? Was that trying to foist some of the blame on him?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's what's funny about that to me is I remember hearing Andy Dillon's name come up when I was asking questions about this in the fall. I remember the governor's spokesperson, previous spokesperson, and the former spokesperson for the Department of Environmental Quality sort of say, you know, look, this was Andy Dillon's call. And I was like, what? Andy Dillon? God, he hasn't been around in a while. And then when I look back at the timeline, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, Andy Dillon was the treasurer at the time. And the reason Andy Dillon had to sign off on this is because it was any city's school districts under an emergency manager, if they want to spend money over a certain amount, not only the emergency manager has to sign off, but the actual treasurer has to sign off. So that's why Dillon was sort of in the loop on this. But yeah, it is sort of interesting that, you know, Dillon,
Dane Walling, the former mayor, you're hearing those names mentioned a lot.
Yes. Yeah. But Dillon is, you know, he's a Democrat, really. And so it is kind of interesting that, you know, the Republican administration, certainly if you're a political person, you know, that's sort of brought up here in that context, I guess.
Lindsay, as someone who, as we said, has been reporting on this story for many, many months, does this release by Governor Snyder's office satisfy you in terms of transparency?
I would really like to see his emails from 2013. That's when the actual decision to switch to the Flint River was made. He released emails from 2014 and 2015, but the ones from 2013 weren't included, and I'm not sure why they weren't included or if they will eventually release those two. It's not clear to me on that. Those are the ones that I'd really like to see. If there was anything super bad in these emails, I can't imagine he would have just openly released them. So I would have been surprised if there really was a bombshell in here, is kind of how I looked at it.
So as we kind of try to digest this ever-growing Flint water story, Lindsay, what's at the top of your list of questions that you think still need to be answered?
In relation to the emails, there's one thing in particular that caught my eye that I've been trying to confirm. And that is whether or not the Department of Environmental Quality has terminated some staffers within that department, because there's an email at the very end, right around the time that the governor realizes that the department's director, Dan Wyant, is going to resign. They talk about Dan Wyant resigning, and then we know that the former spokesperson, Brad Werfel, resigned. But there's talk, too, about terminating some other employees within the DEQ. And as far as I know, no one at the DEQ, staffer-wise, has been terminated because of this. So I'm trying to figure out if that's something that happened or will happen, and we just don't know about it yet. But otherwise, the things that I'll be looking for in the future, I think the most pressing thing is, how will we know, what is the process for figuring out when Flint's water will be safe to drink again? Like all this bottled water stuff and the filters and getting this stuff to people. But like, if you live in Flint, when will we know and how will we know when our water is safe to drink? So that's one of the most, to me, one of the most more immediate things, if I was living in Flint, that I would care about.
Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith, not the first and definitely not the last time we'll be talking with you about your reporting on the Flint water crisis. Thanks so much, Lindsay.
Thanks for having me.
Collaborative.
Experimentation.
The next idea.
We need a participation revolution, and we need it fast.
One of the important keys to future innovation and prosperity in Michigan is channeling and then training young people to fill the jobs that will make up the economy of the future. And that's where Advance Michigan steps up. It's an economic collaboration among governmental agencies, schools, and the business community. And it happened because of a special designation that Southeast Michigan got from the federal government. And it's brought millions of dollars of investment to our state. Mike Coast is the vice chair of Advance Michigan, as well as being the president of the Michigan Manufacturing Technology Center. Good to have you with us, Mike.
Thank you.
And we welcome Joe Petrosky. Joe is dean of the Engineering and Advanced Technology Department at Macomb Community College. Good to have you with us, Joe.
Good to be here.
Mike, start by explaining just how Advance Michigan works. I'm wondering who makes up the partnership and how much money are we talking about? Where does this pot of money come from?
Well, originally it was set up, it's called the Investing in Manufacturing Community Partnership, which was an opportunity that was put out by the Economic Development Administration, the EDA. It was set up originally by President Obama to set up a national competition. And there were 74 regions around the country that were eligible for that. And there were going to be 12 awards. So we won 12 out of 74 in southeastern Michigan. It allowed us to get access to roughly $1.2 billion in additional federal funding from about 16 different federal agencies. The whole idea was to bring together all of the partners in southeastern Michigan in order to set up Advanced Michigan.
What are the most important areas of economic growth that Advanced Michigan is working on? What kind of projects is it funding?
Well, it was used to develop partnerships from around the region. And then it was based on five pillars: workforce and talent, supply chain, research and innovation, site development and infrastructure, trade and international investment, and capital access and process improvement. We had teams of people working on those five pillars to write portions of the proposal so that we could get that specific designation. Now we have Advanced Michigan in place, and it's a partnership of a 13-county region anchored by the cities between Detroit, Flint, Pontiac, Lansing, and Ann Arbor, and of course their surrounding communities. And so far, we've been able to bring in roughly $34 million.
That's a lot of money, a lot of partners, and a lot of different projects.
One of the things that it really did is in southeastern Michigan, not everybody comes to the table and plays nicely. And so what it did is it allowed all of the community colleges, all the economic development organizations to come together with a common effort and bring them together.
Under the one umbrella.
Under one umbrella. To me, that was the real advantage for the entire effort, is to bring everybody together, to go out jointly and not have a specific agenda pointed to one organization, but to go out and then try and find these opportunities for the better good of southeastern Michigan.
Joe Petrosky, let me bring you in here and ask, with all of these different projects funded within or under, really, that umbrella of Advance Michigan, how has Macomb Community College been able to take advantage of this? What has it let you do that you otherwise would not have been able to do?
One of the first projects that we have taken advantage of the partnership is with the American Apprenticeship Initiative proposals that came out from the federal government last year. We did submit a proposal for that, and we're successful in receiving it. It's called the MAP Plus, the Michigan Apprenticeship Plus. We partnered with Grand Rapids Community College.
So you're linking high schools and community colleges and engineering employers, so that's the triad we really need to make strong.
We are, very much so. And apprenticeships are being rediscovered these days. There's a strong emphasis on them from a federal level. It's a wonderful mechanism for workforce development. And Michigan historically has been very strong in apprenticeships, but that kind of died down as we went through that long recession. And unfortunately, a lot of companies cut back on their hiring. They cut back on their apprenticeships. The people that used to coordinate those apprenticeships have since retired. So this grant, we're able to bring that back. And you mentioned high schools. That's a key part of it, reestablishing that connection from the high schools, that pipeline, so to speak, making our youth aware of these great types of jobs, and then preparing them, pre-apprenticeship-type academies that we'll be hosting, preparing them for the world of work, having them meet up with employers and putting them to work, hopefully, in apprenticeships.
And if there's one thing we've heard over and over, it's employers saying, we have these jobs and we can't find people to fill them, and we have young people who are hoping to find, you know, a life's career that will support their families.
Absolutely, and particularly here in Michigan. I mean, the heart and soul of manufacturing and the automotive, and it still surprises me that the lack of awareness sometimes amongst our youth of the great careers that are in the automotive industry and in automotive manufacturing. You know, it's changed radically over the last 30 years, and the types of skills that are required, again, very high-tech, very leading-edge skills. And as we see just coming off of the auto show and being in the auto show, it's an exciting industry, and it's a great one to be working in.
You know, my organization, the Michigan Manufacturing Technology Center, we go out and work with hundreds of manufacturing companies a year. And when we walk in, the first thing we do is we ask them, what keeps you awake at night? And invariably, they turn around and said, hiring skilled labor. So they want production workers, they want welders, they want CNC operators. And on the professional level, they want IT workers, any kind of person that's got a manufacturing engineering degree. That's what keeps the small companies awake at night. And the things that Joe talked about that he's working on, which are the apprenticeship programs, they're making a comeback. They need them. Companies need skilled workers, and they need these programs put in place for an apprenticeship so that they can keep their factories full. And Joe's 100% right. You know, the automotive industry is now at a 17.5 million car build rate right now. The plants that are left are getting filled up. They need more workers to come in and help them do those kind of things.
Turn out the cars.
It's a lot of work.
This question's for both of you, and I will start with you, Mike Coast. What do you hope, as you think about our employment landscape in Michigan, what do you hope that it will look like 10 years down the road?
45% of all the companies we go out and work with are automotive related. And so when you start to look at things that are coming down the road, lightweighting is now becoming a key. So you're going to have to figure out what companies are going to be left standing and what new companies are going to come up out of the woodwork, if you will, to address the lightweighting. So it starts with steel, then it goes to high-strength steels, then it's going to go to aluminum, then it's going to go to composites, and then all the joining technologies that are going to be in place to make that happen.
Knowing that we've got these fuel standards by 2025 that they've got to meet.
They have to meet them. It's going to be coming. It's kind of like, what kind of skills are going to be needed down the road? And so when we look at one of our partners, which is Macomb Community College, and say, what are they going to set up as two-year degree programs or apprenticeship programs to meet the technologies for the joining things that are going to happen, the OEMs, the tier ones, and then the small companies? And by the way, are the OEMs and tier ones important? Absolutely. But 85% of the manufacturing are the small plants that are out there, the ones that Joe is helping set up.
The supply base.
The supply base, yeah. I mean, without question.
And what are your thoughts on that, Joe?
the next 10 years are going to continue to be very exciting. All the advances that Mike mentions, the automobile, the connected, the automated vehicle, again, new skill sets in the IT world and the area of sensors and how vehicles are communicating with each other. That's a new area that's open for apprenticeships also. I mentioned we're partnering with Grand Rapids Community College. They're focused on information technology apprenticeships. So some of those are going to be emerging and be very strong. The skill set will continue to change. We've seen that over the last decade plus. And there's, in fact, a new report survey that's out from the World Economic Forum talking about the robotics. And by 2020, they're projecting, you know, what their net losses are in jobs, which is a big number, but then also their net gains. And so I view that as kind of shifting. The same thing that we've seen over the last 10, 20 years is new technologies come on place, automated technologies. They're displacing certain jobs and requiring other jobs. Our mechatronics program continues to be very popular. And that's a program that trains individuals to be working on automated systems. Automated systems robotics is going to be continuing to increase. It's going to be continuing to move into the small and the medium-sized companies. The prices go down. The productivity goes up. You need people to design those. You need people to repair those. You need to know about the electronics and the control systems and the hydraulics. So those are all skill sets that will very much continue to be in demand.
Mike, thinking of this designation that we've got now with Advanced Michigan, what areas in Michigan could be elevated to national prominence because of this designation?
Well, Michigan has always been a leader in the automotive industry. We're recognized as the automotive capital of the world. And all the engineers and the tech centers, people forget sometimes. They always talk about the Detroit 3, but then the OEMs that are in southeastern Michigan and all of the technology centers that are out there that hire all of those high-level engineers that are so dearly needed in the manufacturing world. That's going to be another huge opportunity for us. And then lightweighting also falls over into transportation, airplanes, trucks, tanks. I mean, there's going to be another huge need for those industries as they're coming down, and that's an opportunity for Michigan to grow. We want to make Michigan one of those places where people come to get those jobs. And just the fact that the automotive industry is taking off and going is a catalyst to bring those new people, the new jobs from other states to Michigan.
And Joe Petrosky's thinking, and I want my students in those jobs.
I want my students in those jobs. I agree with Mike on all of that, talking about the auto show. The National Automotive Center has a display down there. And again, people don't often think about defense and automotives and the similarities. And they're highlighting their connected vehicles and the lightweighting and all of the things that the automotive industry is putting in is happening in the defense world, too. And again, Michigan, Southeast Michigan, is a powerhouse for the defense world as well as aerospace. I know the aerospace industry right now is wrestling with, you know, how do we produce planes quicker? Boy, there's a whole lot of lessons learned in the automotive industry, and you've seen the supply base supplying aerospace increase over the last 5-10 years in Southeast Michigan.
Joe Petrosky is the Dean of the Engineering and Advanced Tech Department at Macomb Community College, and Mike Coast is the Vice Chair of Advanced Michigan, as well as the President of the Michigan Manufacturing Technology Center. It was great talking about Advanced Michigan with both of you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside was engineered today by Bod Scon. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Ryan Grimes, Sean McHenry, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.